Perry Marshall, and I am here with Chris Hearn. And Chris is author of The Entrepreneur's Secret to Creating Wealth. Chris is actually a banker. Now, that's a weird guy for me to be talking to here. I don't usually talk to bankers. I barely even know one, frankly. But as my business has grown, as my clients have matured, and as I've progressed, I've found that being smart about money and finance is really important, and knowing about marketing and entrepreneurship is not enough if you want the whole picture to really work. So I wanted to have a conversation with Chris. And Chris, I know him from a private mastermind group that I was a part of, and Chris was and is a very interesting gentleman, because he is a true blue entrepreneur and small business person in addition to being a banker. And he's one of the very, very few people who in the last few years has actually started a bank. And so he deals with some pretty savvy cats. And so he's got a book out. He has a company that does some very interesting things. And so I wanted to have a wide-ranging conversation with Chris about money and banking and lending and equity and selling businesses. And, like, how do you actually build up wealth as opposed to just generating cash flow? So that's why I got Chris here. So, Chris,
hey, Perry.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Hopefully nobody's turned off the CD yet or the audio file yet.
Well,
you've put up the banker notation on me.
Well, you know, Chris is not, you know, you're not a, like, roll in at 8:55 and leave at 5:05 guy in a black suit.
Right.
That's for sure. So why don't you give people an idea, before you get into the banking stuff, could you just give everybody a flavor of some of the different things that you've been doing? You've had some franchises,
mm-hmm.
and like, and you've dabbled in the info marketing world. Give me an idea. I have an idea. Give everybody else an idea.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not the traditional banker, as you've already alluded to. And hopefully we haven't lost everybody yet. But I started my own company about 10 years ago called Mercantile Capital Corporation. And all we do is finance commercial property for small business owners around the United States. And we've done it from startups all the way to $100, $150 million a year companies in terms of revenue. And done a lot of franchises. And that actually led me to do my own franchise, as you alluded to. Probably have financed about 6 or 7 different franchise concepts over the years. We're up to about $1.2 billion in total project amounts, and these are small business deals, so that gives you a flavor of how many things we've done. In 38 states, Puerto Rico, District of Columbia. So I like the franchise business model. I started my own franchise because I didn't have enough to do, apparently. Or really, I'm just sort of a serial entrepreneur. And so I started a high-end men's barbershop chain called Kennedy's All-American Barber Club, which is in 4 states now. We launched probably the worst time we could, which was August of 2008. I think the world, from a financial perspective, about ended the very next month. And,
yeah.
You know, we haven't had quite as much franchise unit growth as we had projected, but we've had a tremendous amount of store unit growth, meaning the members and the customers, and it's really taken off. And getting ready to open next week, actually, our 14th location. So so I've done that, and gosh, I don't know. I wrote the book, started about 4 years ago. Shortly after we were on the Inc. 500 list for the first time, we were actually on the list 3 times in a row. And it was going to originally be the first book in the Inc. 500 imprint with Greenleaf. And I tried, as probably a lot of you listening, you know, as an entrepreneur, you try to outsource things that maybe you're not the best at, perhaps. And one of the things I've been very good at is writing short articles, and, you know, for publications and things like that. And I do a lot of media and radio and TV and all sorts of things. And, but I'd never written, you know, it's one thing to write a 1,500 word article. It's another thing to write a 65,000 word book. And so I tried the ghostwriting route and failed miserably at that. In fact, I used two different ghostwriters, hated what they both came up with. I didn't think it represented my voice very well. So eventually I retooled and eventually got it done with a different publisher, and it launched October 1st, and it's gotten very good reviews, and I've got some pretty notable people in the small business sector of the economy that have reviewed it and endorsed it. You know, editor at large Inc. magazine and co-founder of Fast Company magazine, and T. Parr Ecker, who's you know, pretty well known. He sold millions and millions of books, and different folks like that. So I'm pretty pleased, and that's a quick thumbnail sketch about me. Harry, we can, you know me, I'm an open book, so we can talk about anything else you want.
So what was it that you knew about small businesses or about the world in general that caused you to decide to start a bank?
And, well, you know,
this is a weird thing. Like, it's a lot of red tape for serial entrepreneur, let's put it that way, right?
Yeah, it is. I grew up in a somewhat of an entrepreneurial family. I mean, I was raised by a single parent. My mother, who is in Downsdale, Illinois. I think you know I'm from Illinois, outside of Peoria. Well known as a chocolatier, believe it or not. I learned my first sales experience was working with her. To this day, I can still be a bit of a chocolate snob if somebody put something in front of me. I started in the Midwest. A lot of boys, especially, do lawn maintenance companies. And you know what that means is in the spring and summer you're cutting grass, in the fall you're raking leaves, and in the winter you're shoveling snow until your back aches. And so I started that at about age 8, and I talk about this a little bit in the book. When I was 13, I actually helped my mother pass the residential real estate licensing exam, and that made a sort of a profound impact on me in terms of looking at all these buildings as something different than just these structures that I just passed by every day and didn't really give it too much thought at all. And so that kind of stuck with me, and years later, I was the first in my family to go to college. I went to college in Chicago, eventually wound my way out to Philadelphia for grad school, and I worked for a high-tech startup before in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., before that became sort of fashionable to do, and became one of the top salespeople there until the recruiters came calling, and they encouraged me to go to GE Capital. This is back when Jack Welch, pretty famous CEO, was in charge. And it was an opportunity for me to use my master's degree in finance and to do that. And, what I was doing was working with small businesses, which is something, I'd done. I'd always considered myself somewhat of an entrepreneur up to that point. And I had, I'm skipping over a lot of stuff, but I had entrepreneurial ventures in college and in high school and all sorts of different things. And it was a way to work with small business people, which I liked. The difference in working with a small business owner typically is that individual can make a decision right then and there. If you work with big companies, it takes a long, long time. The sales cycle drags out. A lot of times you're dealing with decision by committee and things that just, it doesn't fit with sort of my ADD personality. So small business people, I'm one of them. I relate to them. That's who I wanted to work with. And so years later, when I decided to basically do this on my own, with my own company, much of what I did at GE Capital, I specifically wanted to work with this niche, with this group of people, because I think I resonate so well with them. And so that's what we do.
Okay. So, while you were talking about that, I was just thinking, the speed at which things can happen in small businesses, a lot of why people want to be in small business, the corporate world. Oh, my goodness. Watching glaciers melt. Right?
Yeah, it's much faster.
So you realized the... the mismatch between the speed of the normal corporate banking world and the speed at which, usins have to work, right?
Right, exactly.
And this isn't like, this isn't a very easy merger of two worlds, right? I mean,
no,
Well, for the last year, I've been talking to this guy about getting a line of credit, for crying out loud. Like, a year has gone by.
Right.
You know, well, you know, glad I don't, like, need the money.
Right.
So tell, what are the unique things that you have had to do, and, you know, what is it that an entrepreneur doesn't even know to ask a guy like you?
Well, let me come back to the second question. Let me answer the first, which is when I started out about 10 years ago on my own with this company, I was in every box of the organizational chart. Okay, I was doing it all from soup to nuts. And fortunately, I was blessed to know a guy who I had invested with before on some commercial real estate development deals. And he was a former bank president who really, from what I could tell, wanted to get back into the banking world. But much like me, he wanted to do it on his own terms. And so he and I started talking, and this guy's 22 years my senior. And, push comes to shove, we decided to launch Mercantile. And it's worked out really well. In fact, I mean, there's probably a book in me about that by itself, about, having a partner who... your weaknesses are his strengths, and vice versa, and it's worked really well for us. He's much more of we call it Mr. Outside, Mr. Inside. You know, I'm Mr. Outside. I'm the guy who's extremely comfortable and very skilled with sales and marketing and PR, publicity, all these types of things, and strategy. And he's much more comfortable, Mr. Inside, as, you know, more administrative, and he handles our closings and things like that. That's much more along his lines, and so it works really well, kind of yin and yang type of a thing. So that's helped a lot. And it's allowed me, candidly, Perry, to focus more on, how do I put this, putting out what's different about us, making us stand out. I mean, when we started this company, we never wanted to be just like a typical bank. We wanted to be different. We wanted to do things against the norm, to defy conventions, to, for instance, I think, you've known me for many years. I mean, I'm a big marketer. I mean, you don't see that kind of a skill set very often in a banker. Whether you believe the whole right brain, left brain thing or whatever, it's just not very common to have somebody who has the financial skill set along with the marketing skill set. You just don't see that very often. And quite frankly, banks, as regulated as we are now, especially with some of the laws in the last few years, I mean, it's a massive headache. You would drive me crazy if I didn't have this buffer of my partner and some of the other folks, obviously, we've hired over the years, who can deal with some more of that sort of red tape and the stuff that I despise. And frankly, it's a big governor. It's a big drag on me to have to deal with some of that stuff. I deal with it as best I can, and I'm certainly not exempt from having to deal with a lot of the stuff, but it's not the highest and best use of my time. So I try to focus on, telling the marketplace about us and what makes us different, what makes us unique, and why people should work with us. So that's the answer to the first question. You got to remind me of the second one, because I sometimes just get in the flow.
So that's perfect. So what is it that entrepreneurs don't even know to ask you,
right,
about money, banking? So most of us are bootstrapped,
yep,
and, between the credit cards and the home equity loan and the wing and the prayer, the duct tape and the bailing wire, we manage,
yep,
to make it all work, okay?
Yep.
So eventually, you get up to this point and, well, okay, so I got employees, I got things that occasionally come up that are very unexpected, weird bills or the IRS or whatever, and you start to realize, well, just being able to sell something, probably I need to know more than that, but I don't even know what to ask.
Yeah.
So what should I even start asking so that guys like you can make me rich?
Well, it's that's a really broad question, but
start somewhere.
Let me try and hone in a little bit. The first thing I would say is I get this question a lot. you know, how do I start off, or what should I do to begin with? And frankly, it gets to what we're going to talk about the book, which is, you know, fundamentally, if you have a brick and mortar business, converting what is typical for most people, which is a leased facility into a commercial mortgage facility. Same reason why people move out of apartments into homes. Basically, that's in a nutshell, but we'll go into more detail later. But so I regularly talk people out of doing this right out of the gate. You know, somebody hears me speak, or they read some publication that I was in, or whatever the case is, and they think that this is what they want to do, and they're at the idea in the garage stage. It's way too early. I mean, bottom line is, when you're first starting out, which I think gets to the answer to your question, your capital, whatever it is, you know, if it's VC money, which, and by VC money, I mean Visa card. I don't mean like venture capital, because it's not very practical or realistic for most people. But whether it's VC money, it's other credit cards, it's friends and family, it's, you know, your savings, what have you, your capital is so precious starting out. And really, you know, at the end of the day, if you're going to be an entrepreneur and you have an idea, and hopefully it's a solution to some sort of a problem, that's fundamentally what we do, and you've come up with this creative solution, you've got to prove the concept first, and you've got to work your way into the marketplace to get some, you know, build a bit of a foundation underneath you, you know, way before you contemplate buying commercial property. I mean, if there's anything about the book that I wrote, it's definitely not a get-rich-quick scheme. I don't think there's too many of those out there that are truly legitimate. I mean, the bottom line is, it's going to be a grueling 2 or 3 years in most businesses. That's been my experience. First 2 or 3 years, you're going to be working your butt off, and that's okay, and frankly, that's the fraternity that we all have been in. Okay?
Yep.
It's once you get to year 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, you start bringing on board people, because you can't do it yourself entirely. I mean, you know, yeah, you might be able to top out at, you know, maybe $1 million in gross revenue or something if you're an info marketing genius or something by yourself, but short of, you know, anywhere beyond that, you're going to need people to help you. You're going to need to build a team. And building a team is going to mean that you've got to have hopefully systemized some of your processes. You're going to have now a payroll. You may, in fact, need more cash. You may need that line of credit that you're talking about. I mean, and hopefully you're showing some profits. I mean, that's the other thing is as entrepreneurs, I've never yet met an entrepreneur who really enjoys paying taxes. Most of us want to try and, you know, we want to pay what's legally required, but we don't want to pay a dime more. You have to understand there's a fine line between demonstrating that you're bankable, meaning that you, if a bank lends you money, you will pay them back. You're a good credit risk, versus on the other end of the, on the other side of the line, you know, trying to keep your tax liability to next to nothing. Okay, so at some point you got to make that switch. Okay, you can't just keep expensing everything through the business and thinking, this is brilliant, I'm never going to have to pay taxes. Well, eventually you're going to get a knock on the door from that IRS agency out in Washington who's going to be a little concerned that you've gone 7 years without making a profit. They have a problem with that sort of a thing. Not to mention you'll have a difficult situation trying to go to somebody like me and borrow money. And, you know, small business owners, they need to borrow money at some point. You know, it happens. I mean, you get a, you know, depending on your business, you get a big purchase order and you don't have enough cash to float the inventory required if you have to buy inventory ahead of time. Or you know, there's a lot of scenarios I could get into, but you're going to need to show some profitability. And that's why I tell people, you don't want to buy commercial property. Even though it makes great sense, great way to create wealth for a business, you certainly don't want to do it in the first couple, 2-3 years. Does that answer the question somewhat?
Okay, so what I hear you saying is, well, all right, you can't keep rolling the expenses into infinity, and you got to make some money. And what you're also starting to say is that if you want to roll something into somewhere, buying commercial property is a really good place to make that money disappear. Is that what
Yes.
you're saying?
That's one of the things I'm saying. Yeah, absolutely. And we are living in a time right now, Perry, where commercial real estate values have come down. They've literally plummeted.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the average across the board decrease is 42%, according to the Wall Street Journal a couple months ago, nationwide. This is from their high of back in 2007. So, you know, assets are on sale. You know, people generally look for things that are discounted, okay? That's a time when smart people try to buy things. You have that as one piece of the perfect storm. The other piece of this good perfect storm is that we are at historic lows in terms of interest rates. Most commercial property is not paid for in cash. It's financed. And as it should be, because it's, frankly, it's what I would call good debt. Okay, there's a difference. If we need to get into that, I will. But the bottom line is you can probably own right now for less than you can continue renting. And certainly the tax advantages over time certainly bear that out, but even more so right now. And if you have a brick-and-mortar business, you have to have a facility. Instead of paying your landlord your rent, which covers their mortgage and gets them wealthy, what I teach in the book is exactly sort of the blueprint of how to do it to pay yourself the rent. And actually, over time, yeah, you can pull out additional cash out of the business to do this as you're building equity in an appreciable asset, such as real estate. I don't really get into things in the book about, you know, what to do in your business. This is really something, this is sort of something that overlays on top of your business if you're the business owner. And frankly, even what I mostly suggest to people is creating a separate real estate holding company to do this, to tie everything together, which, again, I get into a lot of details in the book, but to answer your question, I mean, this is an easy way for a business owner to create wealth, and you know, it works. It works extremely well, and it's something I've done myself even.
So hopefully everybody's familiar with, hey, you know, you gotta buy a house instead of renting. This is kind of the same, but how is it different? I think there's a lot more layers to this and more interesting things you can do. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it's a lot different. I mean, frankly, I don't know much about residential mortgages short of the ones I've taken out myself, but it's very different. I mean, the home marketplace is much, much more bigger than the commercial property space and much more fluid and dynamic than commercial property. So there's a lot of things to consider. You know, when not everybody's going to have the option to buy the facility they're in right now. I mean, it's not practical. I mean, you could be in a multi-tenant office building if you have some service company or something, and you aren't going to have the opportunity to buy the property. But a lot of businesses, they're also not as, you know, we've always heard that location, location, location in the residential space. It's not as keen in the commercial space. I mean, it can be. I mean, if you're a retailer,
yeah,
you have a restaurant or something like that, perhaps. But in general, most businesses are not as location dependent as we would initially think. I mean, I've got plenty of past clients who have bought a piece of property that was 10 or 15 miles down the road, you know, although I've got others that want to be, you know, three blocks. And I talk about in the book, you know, if you're a, some of this depends on the business itself. I mean, if you're an attorney, if you're a litigator and you need to be across the street from the courthouse and that's just not a piece of property that you can buy, then this may not be for you. You know, if you're more of a business attorney that deals a lot in contracts, or maybe you're an elder law attorney or something like that, well, you might be able to be in the suburbs in a nice office building that you own. I mean, so it just kind of depends. We get into a lot of that in the book. You know, I talk about how a lot of people, sort of their go-to is, you know, call their brother-in-law who's the residential real estate agent and have him go and try and find some property for you. And that's, you know, if you value your time, that's not real wise use of it. Because there is definite a huge gulf of knowledge difference from the residential to the commercial side. And not just in the folks that know the properties, you know, the real estate agents or brokers, but in the inspectors, you know, a home inspector. Sometimes home inspectors also do commercial property inspections, but a lot of times they don't. You know, if you have to do some tenant improvements or renovations on the property, which, candidly, that's another way to stretch your dollar, to buy a piece of property that's not quite what you want, but to renovate it into what you want. Right now, it makes great sense, and I'll come back to that in a second, give you an example of that. But general contractors on the residential side of things usually aren't messing around with stuff on the commercial side of things. They just don't. They're too different. There's a wall up between them. What I was going to say about the commercial properties, we've now done about 20 properties that were formerly restaurant properties that have gone closed down or whatever the case is, that we converted into office buildings. Now, why would we do that? Well, first of all, if you drive by one of these, a vacated restaurant property, you wouldn't naturally think that would make a good office property necessarily. But what's interesting is, first of all, the demolition, taking out a bunch of stainless steel kitchen equipment is not that big of a deal. Usually they're well located, okay, which that could be a consideration of yours. Usually has excess parking, okay, and it just it oftentimes also has already has the approved signage requirements in the municipality. So you can usually put up a pretty nice big sign to broadcast your business if it was formerly a restaurant in that spot. So it's just kind of something interesting. I've noticed that over the years that people that have a bigger vision have been able to say, you know what, that'd make a great spot for my, architectural firm or whatever the case is.
So if I'm going to buy one of these properties, there's several things to consider. So one of them is going to be, How many of these deals does the owner have tenants?
Right.
Start with that.
What do you mean by this? So how many deals does the owner
have? Well, if I'm – I go, all right, I want equity in this building. And in 20 years, this could be worth millions of dollars, and this is a great way for me to have some equity that I wouldn't otherwise have. But, wait a minute. Am I now, in order to get into something suitable, am I going to have to buy this big thing? Like, okay, maybe the money works out, but now I'm a landlord. Or like, is this something that often comes up?
Well, what I think you're asking is, first of all, I finance what is called owner-occupied commercial property, which means when you're a dentist or you're, in your case, Perry, maybe you decide, okay, I've outgrown this place, I need to go and buy an office building.
Right.
Most of the time, the folks that I'm financing are occupying the entire square footage. They don't have tenants. Okay. But I've had probably 20-30% of my clients over the years will actually take my advice, which is to buy more than you need, a little bit more than you need, maybe 20%, 30% more than what you require, and sublet out the difference. Now, and I'll give you an example I talk about in the book. There's a financial planner down here that did that very thing. He bought an office condo and bought about 25% more than he needed, had two offices in there that he had tenants in, just sublet it to them, and just those two tenants alone covered his entire mortgage. Which, you think about, okay, he's a financial planner, maybe he would think of that. Most small business owners may not think of that until now, but it does work. There can be headaches, of course, as you said. If you have a bunch of tenants, that can cause you some issues. But then again, it gives you space to grow into down the road. Oftentimes they can cover a big chunk of your mortgage as well, and it can work out pretty well. I generally don't do, and I shy away from truly multi-tenant properties where you're buying a retail strip center and you're one of 10 different people in there. That's not the kind of thing that I normally do.
That's a really interesting thing you bring up, because my first house, the reason I bought it, and the reason I even bought it in the suburb I bought it in, was because it had what we call here an in-law apartment.
Right, yeah.
And, so it's like it's actually a third of the basement, and we got probably $250 a month rent out of it.
Right.
So it's the residential equivalent of what you're saying, and, that was a really good move.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the $250 a month today, that's like, one better word or worse word in the subject line of an email would be $300 in one day. And, it wouldn't make any difference to me now. But you know what? 20 years ago, it made a huge difference.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, and also think about the growth. I mean, if your business is growing, the worst thing you can do is to buy – if you're in 5,000 square feet now and you go and decide you want to use this strategy and you go buy a 5,000 square foot building and you outgrow it in a year, well, then what? I mean, yeah, you'd go buy another building, but now you're not going to quite get the efficiency that you would have by having all your folks in one spot. Maybe that's not a consideration for you. Who knows? But that's why I always encourage people to try and get a little bit more than what they need if they can.
And so they buy 7,000 instead of
right.
five, and it's not a huge amount of effort to deal with one tenant, and
right.
it subsidizes your long-term equity investment.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. So is there a creative side to this that wouldn't exist in the residential end of the world? Since you're up, miles deep into the finance end of the world, and since
right.
commercial is more complicated than residential, then that must open up some opportunities. So what are some things that I would never even think of or be privy to since I owned an in-law apartment and a house?
Well, one thing I think it's important to understand is there are, because of what I said before about that there's just a much, much more massive marketplace for residential versus commercial. Bankers view that as commercial being slightly more risky. Okay, and at the end of the day, that's what bankers are in. They're in the risk management business. Okay,
yep.
And so how do they manage the risk? Well, for one, there's not too many avenues out there from reputable lenders that are going to require no down payment or low down payment when you're buying. Okay, the residential side, there's a lot of stuff like that. If you're a veteran, you could get a VA loan. I mean, there's FHA loans. There's all these different things out there that'll lower your down payment. So to lessen the hurdle of getting into this, okay? You don't have as much of that on the commercial side. Now, we'll come back later and we'll talk about one that actually I talk about in the book. But in general, that's one of the ways that the lender lessens the risk. They take a bigger chunk of cash up front, of capital, the equity capital up front, to lessen their risk. In most cases, commercial properties are financed anywhere from they require anywhere from 20 to 35% of a down payment, okay? So that's a significant amount of cash depending on the size of the property. Another thing they do is they try to manage their risk by not having quite as long of a term on the loan itself, okay? Everybody's familiar with a 30-year residential mortgage, okay? It's very, very common. In fact, believe it or not, there's now people are coming out with 40-year residential mortgages. Part of that's because people are living longer. Part of that's also because it stretches the payment terms, it lowers the monthly payments, but they obviously collect more interest over a longer period of time, all those sorts of things. You don't have that as much in the commercial. You have most commercial mortgages are for 15 or 20 years. Okay. Now, again, there's some programs out there that go a little bit longer, so it can be a little more cash flow sensitive to a business, and that's an important consideration because in business it's always about strategic utilization of your capital. So those are a couple big differences, residential versus commercial, that I think is important to understand. The last one I would say is, believe it or not, the pricing makes a difference. In pricing, and when you're borrowing money, it's about the interest rate. And so residential rates, people understand those are down in the 3-4% range. Commercial is almost always going to be, a point higher, for instance, point and a half higher than prevailing residential rates. And again, that's because it's perceived to be a slightly riskier asset class for the bank than doing a residential mortgage. Even having gone through the Great Recession and, all the subprime mortgage crap and all the other stuff, commercial still has this sort of stigma on it. It's a little more risky to the bank. And part of that is, look, if a bank has to take over your property, okay, so this is worst case scenario, they have to foreclose on your property, it's a whole heck of a lot easier to move a single family, three bedroom, two bath house in the suburbs of Chicago than it is to move a 10,000 square foot restaurant or
right.
or a hotel or whatever. I mean, granted, multi-purpose properties are easier, okay, and those are given some special considerations versus special use properties. But that's part of this dynamic that exists and the differences between residential and commercial. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So before I go into some other topics, I just want you to talk for a little more about, there's kind of a finite set of options of how a business owner is going to build wealth.
Yes.
So, some people might sell their businesses, but not all businesses are readily sellable.
Right.
Right. Not all businesses are going to get lots of money for the sale of the business. Like if you're a dental office with, one or two guys, You're not going to sell that thing for lots of money.
No.
Right? There's things like stocks and bonds and investments and insurance,
right?
Which I think everybody is somewhat familiar with. Why is this a not so obvious good way to retire with, you know, $5 million or $10 million?
Well, I think it's exactly what you're saying, which is you know, if you're a dentist, I mean, maybe you can sell the practice to somebody because you have a built up client base, but more than likely you're going to shut it down. But having said that, you know, if you were a dentist for 30 years, you had to have a place, a brick and mortar place where people, your clients came, okay, your patients came, and my contention is it's just. You can either pay it to the landlord or you can pay it to yourself. And when you do make that exit strategy where you shut it down or you sell it, hopefully, this whole time for 30 years or maybe 25 years, if it took you a few years starting out, you'll have accumulated that much equity in this appreciable asset that's really, I think it can become a terrific retirement strategy for a lot of small business owners. And it doesn't take much to do this. I mean, coming up with a down payment's one thing. But beyond that, a lot of times it actually is less of a monthly payment to do this than continuing to lease the facility that you're in. So it's I think that's where it's not very obvious, Perry. I think business owners, we're all guilty of this. You know, we put on the blinders and we focus on our business, and this is not one of those things necessarily we look at. I mean, in the book I call it the light bulb moment. It's usually, you know, I've talked to people like this. They woke up at 4 a.m. in the morning with a cold sweat because the rent check's due the next day, and they've been paying this rent check for the last 4 years, and they scratch their head in the middle of the night saying, why am I doing this? You know, I'm in this house that I bought 10 years ago. Why don't I do the same thing with my business? And, you know, oftentimes there's this shame of having thrown away money for years. And I try to talk them out of this and say, it's okay. I mean, it's fine. I mean, people do this all the time. But at least you've come to this, decision now, and so, you know, we'll try and help you out so that you don't continue throwing away the capital, because that's really what happens. I mean, it's like I said earlier, it's the equivalent of staying in an apartment the rest of your life. Eventually, if you buy a house, you'll be able to sell that house and hopefully recoup some return on your investment over time. And definitely this thing happens in business, because the business has to have a place anyway to begin with. You know, you can live a very, a life where, you know, you live well below your means and just have a small place or what have you. But if you have to have a decent facility for your business, you might as well own it. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to continue leasing it. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. It's kind of a no-brainer for a lot of situations.
Yeah.
So tell me about a 504. What is that? Because that's a whole thing that you specialize in, and you're kind of the evangelist of it. So
Yeah, I've been called the evangelist and the Pied Piper and all these different things. Well, again, I talk about in the book, so financing the property. Most people are going to have to finance the property. And I go through your options. You know, you can get a conventional bank loan, which is typically going to be in that, 65 to 80% loan to value, okay, which the difference is your down payment. So that's where you get your 20 to 35% down payment.
And that's the hard part. That's why.
Yeah, that's the hard part, right.
That's the not no-brainer part.
Right. Yeah, you got to come up with the cash. Right.
Okay.
But coming up with 20 to 30% of the property value versus coming up with 10% is a whole lot different. And then I get into some of the other programs. There's a small business administration loan program called the 7A, which some entrepreneurs, you know, they're going to recoil when I say SBA and talk about this, but the reality is the agency is very, very different than it was even 10 or 15 years ago. It's to me, I think it's probably one of the most well-run agencies in the federal government, and in a second I'll even give you an example of why we should be modeling other federal programs after these programs. But But the 7A, it's probably, I would call it the flagship program of the SBA. That's what, if you go to your local banker and you say, hey, I'm thinking about buying my commercial property, the first thing the local banker is going to do is say, okay, great, well, if they're lending, which not every bank is right now because of the regulatory pressure they're under, if they're lending, they're going to say, great, we can do it conventionally at, you know, 20 to 35% down, and here's our terms and all this other stuff. And if you have, if you sort of, you know, recoil at that and say, well, you know, I don't quite want to have to, you know, liquefy all my accounts, and I really was hoping you might have something a little bit less down. Typically, they're going to bring up the SBA 7A program. And it also does 90% loan-to-value financing, okay, so 10% down, much better, half, maybe a third of what would otherwise be required. Has a little bit longer terms, okay, probably about 25 years on commercial property, but it has two big downsides that a lot of borrowers aren't aware of until it's too late, until they're too far down the rabbit hole and they just want to get the deal closed. And that, number one, is it typically has variable interest rate. What I mean by that is floating rates. Okay, when you're buying a big asset like property, and this really relates to any heavy asset, okay, heavy long-term assets, you want to try and get fixed rate financing if you can. Okay, if you have a variable financing, you open yourself up to issues down the road as interest rates go up. Okay, and therefore your expenses go up. And it can be a problem. Right now we have artificially low interest rates. This is the time to lock them in if you can, okay, as opposed to float them. And that's a problem with the 7A loan. The other problem with the 7A loan, and this has kind of given the SBA a little bit of a black eye in entrepreneurial circles over the years, is that it's what's called a fully collateralized loan program, which means oftentimes you've got to pledge a second on your house and maybe get a life insurance policy where the bank and the SBA are the beneficiaries, and you might have to have a second lien on your inventory or receivables, things like that. And so a lot of those things, that's a problem for entrepreneurs. You know, if you tie up your inventory and receivables, you may not be able to get that line of credit, for instance, which is a lot of times the assets that are pledged for a line of credit. Not too many entrepreneurs really want to have the bank take a second or a third on their house in order to get their commercial property loan. So there's little things like that. Well, the last thing that a lot of times bankers don't talk about, which is why you said people have referred to me as sort of the evangelist about this, is the program called the 504, or what we rebranded the Smart Choice Commercial Loan, because, you know, it's one of these inane government titles, names, you know, 529, 401k, you know, 1003, yep. all these silly things. Anyway, so we called it a Smart Choice Commercial Loan, and we did that because, number one, I have one of these loans myself, okay? I think it's important from a authenticity standpoint to buy what you sell, okay? I think that's important, and not everybody does that. Okay, so that's number one. But number two, it also does 90% loan-to-value financing. So you still have the 10% down, which is about the best you're going to find in the commercial finance space, short of doing what's called a hard money loan, where you might be able to do lesser down, but you're going to be paying extraordinary interest rates and probably a lot of fees as well, which is not exciting. So you got to balance that off. But the 504 does not require the additional pledging of collateral like the 7A does, and it's principally a fixed rate program. In fact, the way the structure is, and I won't get into all this detail on the phone right now, but I talk about it in the book, the structure is such that almost half the loan has the least expensive financing for commercial property that's available to small business owners. And it actually takes place by a bond offering that happens every month. It's been happening for the last 30-some years. It's basically, I liken it to bringing Wall Street financing to Main Street businesses. And it's typically about a point and a half below prevailing conventional commercial property rates, okay, and it's fixed for 20 years, which in the commercial property financing space, you don't typically find 20-year fixed rate prices. So it's pretty dramatic. You know, anytime you can put down half or a third the money that would otherwise be required, you get a little bit longer terms, which means your monthly payment's going to be lower, and you pay less of your capital towards interest rates, you know, meaning that you actually are getting such a low interest rate. That's a really smart commercial loan, hence the name, the Smart Choice Commercial Loan. And that's the benefit of the 504. The problem with this all, Perry, is that bankers are not incentivized compensated, however you want to say it, to promote the 504, and it's a little more cumbersome to them than doing it conventionally or doing a 7A. And so therein lies sort of my entrepreneurial aha moment, in that here's a product that's superior to anything else out there, but because the prevailing marketplace is such that they don't promote it that much, and it's a little more cumbersome to them, there's my opportunity to jump in here and become the nation's expert at this, which is what I've done over the last 10 years.
So let me make sure I get this right. So essentially what you're saying is that a 504 is at a similar interest rate to residential loans.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's for commercial, and it's fixed for 20 years, which is unusual.
Right.
And because it's got a few more zigs and zags and whatever, banks aren't like stumbling all over themselves to tell you about this.
That's right.
So it's one of these best-kept secrets.
That's exactly right, and that's what I've referred to it as for many years, the best-kept secret in commercial real estate financing. So, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so, all right, so now that I've heard of a 504, like, what's the, isn't there some downside or some problem with it where...
No, not really. I mean, the only downside, and I do talk about this, and I think it's important to know, is because you're getting such a low interest rate and fixing it for so long, the people that are allowing this to happen are effectively bond investors, okay? And so your interest rate payment is their yield, okay? And because it does have the full faith and credit of the U.S. government on this bond, okay? And I'll explain that in a second. They're taking a much lower yield, okay? Meaning your interest rate's much lower, okay? But they want to make sure they can get it for a set period of time. So if you pay this thing off early, yeah, there's what's called prepayment penalties. They exist for the first 10 years of the loan. But frankly, my philosophy is I don't think too many small business owners ought to be buying commercial property with a time horizon that's less than 10 years. Or even maybe you could convince me to go to 5 years. But certainly that's what they'd be looking at. So when I talk to people about this, oftentimes that's the case. I mean, buying commercial property for a small business owner is one of the biggest purchases, if not the biggest purchase they've ever made.
Mm.
Okay. And they're doing it to stay in it for a long period of time. And what's also interesting about these loans is they have a feature called assumability, meaning that these loans are assumable, okay? And again, we're in a very, very historically low interest rate environment. If they were to buy the property, and maybe they have a time horizon that's less than that 10 years, maybe they decide to close the business in 7 years, if they actually sell the business and the property, this loan is assumable for their buyer. And if they can, 7 years from now, if they can assume today's interest rates, I'm pretty sure that's going to also be a real huge benefit for your buyer. So it's not, this whole prepayment thing is not as big of a deal as some people make it out to be. The other piece is almost always you're able to prepay some of the principal without triggering it. I've seen it from 5 to 20%. It kind of depends on the deal, but 5 to 20% of the principal outstanding every year without triggering these things. So, you know, I've had a few people have asked me, you know, I want a separate amortization schedule. I want to get this thing paid off, say, in 6 years. Okay, fine, no problem. Here it is. I've only had a couple people ever take me up on it, truly, because, you know, usually it's pretty big dollars. I mean, most business owners want to say, you know, hey, if I got an extra 10 grand and I want to throw it towards this, can I do that? And usually that's the case. When they realize that, hey, they can actually put 100 grand towards it every year, that's usually when they back off and say, no, I'm not going to have quite that much cash available for this. So it's not a big deal. And that's the only downside of a 504 for the borrower. For the banker, yes, it's a little more cumbersome of a process. That's why we've chosen to specialize in it. And for us, we're actually faster than getting a conventional loan at a bank these days, much faster, actually. So it's not a big deal. It's that classic example of a best-kept secret that's really a special program. It does wonderful things, and people just need to know about it more, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
So give me an example of somebody who's very typical small business, who's done this, and give me an idea of, you know, like size of property, cost of property, and based on reasonable projections, what they're going to own in 20 years. Could you an example of somebody
yeah.
that...
Well, I mean, the reality is I've done so many different properties, so many different small businesses. I mean, we can just use a generic one, but let's just say you're going to buy $1 million office building, okay? And by the way, your listeners can they can download a free app, iTunes or the whatever the Google, the Android store is, and they can run these calculations. It's the Smart Choice Loan Calculator. It's a free app, so they can do that and they can play with it all day long. But bottom line is, let's just assume you're going to buy a $1 million piece of property today. If you take a very conservative, say 3% appreciation in value. And you forecast that over the next, 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
Using the rule of 72 from finance, that means it's going to be worth slightly more than $2 million at that rate of return.
Okay.
So,
and they're going to pay time doing the math in my head. What's a monthly payment on a piece of
$1 million loan today? Let me go to my calculator. But the $1 million project, it's about anywhere from $5,300 to $5,800 a month. But you're looking at basically $103,000 down, because we also finance the closing costs, believe it or not, in this too. That compares to if you were doing an ordinary bank loan, which it gives you all the computations, couple hundred thousand to $360,000 down, and interest rates, the monthly payment of anywhere from $5,800 to about $6,900. So call it, $1,000 less a month doing this program versus doing a conventional bank program, and you had to come up with half to a third of the money down. So it makes a big difference.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Yep, yes.
They had to come up with $100,000 cash in order to secure the loan, right?
Right.
Because the loan-to-value is 90%. And is the interest deductible the way it is?
Yes.
Okay. So.
Yeah. What happens is your interest expense is a write off. Your depreciation and amortization expense will be a write off. Commercial property you can depreciate over 39.5 years. Okay. So what'll happen is let me kind of put it on a granular level. Let's say you have this $1 million property. You're going to have to put down $100,000. You're going to have a $900,000 mortgage. What most of my clients do is they form a separate real estate holding company. It can be an LLC, an LP, whatever. It's called an eligible passive concern. Okay? And so what you're doing is the business is still continuing to pay rent, but instead of paying it to your landlord, you truly are now paying it to yourself. You're paying it to this real estate holding company that you own. Okay? And what happens is let's use some simple numbers here. Let's say you pay $10,000 a month. That's your rent payment. So you're paying $120,000 a year. Okay. Well, you may be quote unquote sheltering a big chunk of what you paid in that real estate holding company. Okay. Meaning maybe $20,000 of that amount is your interest expense per year, and maybe another $10,000 is your depreciation, or another $5,000 your amortization. So you've got $35,000 of legitimate, approved, legal exemptions. What am I saying here? Deductions against that $120,000 in revenue. Okay, which means that you're only going to be showing and be taxed on the $85,000, the net amount. Okay, does that make sense?
I think so.
Okay, so you're paying yourself $120,000, but you're only taxed on the $85,000 because you sheltered a portion of that income. Okay,
we're all looking for ways to do that.
Exactly. And what's nice is over time, what ties together your operating company with this real estate holding company is what's called a master lease. Okay. So you'll have a master lease that's equivalent to the term of the mortgage. So if you have a 25-year term or something like that, that's what it'll be. But you can have things in your operating, in your operating agreement, for the LLC that maybe your rent payment goes up every year by 3 or 5%. Okay? So it's another way that you can extract more cash out of the business, and you have this legal sheltering mechanism from which to do it. At the same time, you're building up equity in this asset over here. So it makes brilliant sense. I mean, I regularly hear from financial planners and accountants advising their clients to do this very thing.
Well, that's great. Very interesting. So
yeah, sure.
Chris's book is Entrepreneur's Secret to Creating Wealth. It's got a lot of information about the 504, and Chris tell everybody your website and, you know, how they can, if they, you can do this for people, right? I mean, this is
part
of the point, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You set these things up. Are there any, in addition to the, you know, the, doing the loan, you obviously bring a certain amount of financial and entrepreneurial awareness to the table.
Right.
So.
This is what we do. We finance these properties. So how do they get a hold of me? You can go to 504experts.com. 504experts.com, or they can, if they're interested in the book, which I would suggest, go to theentrepreneursecretbook.com, or, you know, they just go directly to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever. It's also in Hudson bookstores, a lot of other, you know, offline bookstores. If people buy two or more copies, this is what's kind of cool that I did. If they buy two or more copies, there's a whole explanation in the book of how to send me a receipt. I actually donate all the net proceeds to the Young Entrepreneur Foundation, which is a group that teaches high school students how to become entrepreneurs of the future. And so I'm pretty passionate, as you know, about entrepreneurship, and I felt like this was a good way to try and, you know, sort of pay it forward, I guess. I don't like to say give back, because I don't think anybody's taking anything, but at least pay it forward. And this time of year, obviously, hopefully people can get a copy of the book for themselves and maybe give the other copy to somebody else as a gift.
That's great. Well, Chris, thanks for enlightening us into these things. And, you know, a lot of us get all obsessed with serial entrepreneurship and sales and marketing and kind of forget that we could be quietly, building up a nice asset while we go. So.
Yeah, exactly. And I know you like esoteric topics, so I thought this
yeah.
was perfect for you.
I do. Well, good. Well, Chris, thank you very much. And
Well, thanks for having me, Perry.
Appreciate your time today.
All right, take care. Happy holidays.
You bet. Bye.